I mean, the meaning of play was, I think, much, much wider than today. It would sort of include not only playing the specific game as it was designed, but also, you know, hacking the game or making your own games, you know, taking screenshots of the games and then printing them out, which was not easy at the time. And like all these different practices, you know, creating demos and learning how to program. I think that computer games were part of it, but it was a very kind of all-encompassing kind of idea, playing with a computer rather than playing on a computer.
This is Henry Jenkins, and you're listening to How Do You Like It So Far, a podcast about popular culture in a changing world. We're joined today by Yaroslav Svelch, who is the author of a new book, Gaming the Iron Curtain, How Teenagers and Amateurs in Communist Czechoslovakia Claimed the Medium of Computer Games. And I wrote the blurb for this book, so I can tell you right away that it is, in fact, a book that speaks to the larger question of consumer culture, technology in the Soviet bloc during the Cold War. So even if you're not interested in games, I think there's a lot here that's going to engage you in this discussion. So, Yaroslav, welcome to How Do You Like It So Far?
Thanks for inviting me.
So tell us a little bit about your journey, how you, what your experiences were as a gamer in what's now the Czech Republic, and how that led you to write this particular book.
So I was one of the early adopters of home computers in the country in the 1980s, thanks to my dad, who was a professional programmer. And I started exploring the community around home computers in, you know, the late 80s and the early 90s. So it was sort of at the tail end of the Soviet bloc era. But I had some really kind of interesting and kind of intense memories of how it was, trading software on cassette tapes and exploring software that came, you know, from the West, but also software that was made domestically. And at one point when I started doing my PhD, I was looking for a way of combining this like long-standing interest of mine in, you know, games with the focus of the department, which was on history of media. And this was one of the directions. But in a way, I think that one of the defining moments was when I came to Boston, to MIT, and I could for the first time share my experiences and my memories with people from other countries. And I found out that there were really interesting differences in which the communities worked in different countries and in which games were defined as a medium in different countries. And I think then I kind of found out or started finding out the ways into this topic and the ways to approach it.
So it's in some ways a book about gaming in Czechoslovakia is kind of counterintuitive. I think if most people think about a book on the history of games, they would think of the major media producers like the US or Japan. So tell us what we learned by looking at games and gaming in Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting context because it's in a way, it's a contrast to what was happening in sort of the more kind of market-oriented, market-driven kind of game industries and development cultures in the West and in Japan. Because in Czechoslovakia, there was really no market because there was no private enterprise. It was basically banned by the government. So most of the activities took place in non-commercial spaces, in computer clubs, usually kind of backed by some paramilitary or youth organizations. And all the games that were being produced were not made for, you know, for profit, but mostly to just like show off or to convey some kind of message or to entertain the author just as well as the players. So it was a very different culture, which made it more personal, the things that were coming out.
So you sort of contrast this gaming culture with the official communist conception of the computer. And so tell us a bit about that. What was the top-down vision of what a computer did?
Yeah, so the communist government and the establishment didn't really think of computers as like a consumer item. The approach to computing was very top-down, as you mentioned. And the people at the, you know, the government and in the Ministry of Electrotechnical Industry, they mainly saw computers as technology that could make existing manufacturing processes more efficient. So they were thinking about using them in factories or using them in state institutions, using them in the military, but there was no conception of getting home computers to the people. I think that the establishment didn't really think of computers as communication devices as we think of them now. They mostly considered them calculation devices. And that also meant that they weren't really that interested in offering computers to the end consumers, to the people. And people were disillusioned because they, some of them had access to, you know, Western press and, you know, to this idea that a home computer is something that you can own and that you can kind of entertain yourself with or use for practical purposes. But the Czechoslovak government couldn't really offer those computers. They were very scarce, and they didn't think it was important to actually, you know, provide computers for the people.
So how do these computers then get into the country? What's the route for consumers?
Yeah, it was not easy, but people found their ways around the Iron Curtain or found these kind of gaps within the Iron Curtain. One of the most frequent ways of getting a computer was individually importing it from the West. So those people who had these permits to travel to the West, not everybody had those, but some people did, could actually, you know, go to, you know, West Germany or Austria or somewhere and buy a computer there. It would be enormously expensive because of the sort of conversion rates, very kind of low buying power of you know, Czechoslovak citizens. But some people did it, and you know, the communities were sort of forming around those kind of early adopters who were bringing computers from the West. Yeah, and there was also a sort of burgeoning black market, people who kind of smuggled computers from the West, and then they were kind of reselling them to hobbyists and to, you know, to computer buffs.
So you in the book, you talk about people creating their own joysticks just to be able to have that peripheral for their computer.
They kind of had to do that because, I mean, there was only like a limited, you know, number of trips you could make to the West. So when you are then, you know, left with your computer that you brought, you know, from Germany, for instance, like when it broke down, you couldn't really kind of send it back to Germany and have it fixed, or you couldn't just go there. And there was no kind of authorized service in Czechoslovakia at that time. So people just had to find ways of fixing those machines themselves. Or if they wanted a peripheral, like a joystick or a mouse, they basically had to build it themselves. This kind of happened in the computer clubs. And like the interesting thing, if you look at those artifacts, is that they sort of combine, you know, bits of Western technology with kind of scrap material that was found locally. And this sort of local ingenuity, just like this kind of tinkering, this kind of, you know, making do with limited resources. So they would, for example, take a calculator apart and from the use the calculator buttons as buttons for the joystick, for example. Or they would just take, you know, piece of like a regular furniture knob and they would make the joystick kind of handle out of that. You can really see the origin of these artifacts in the local material culture.
So presumably then the desire to game is coming through tapping into a variety of information sources. So tell us a little bit about the infrastructure that's supporting the gaming that you're talking about.
In communist Czechoslovakia, it was impossible to gather socially without backing of a socialist organization. So if it was anything more than like a family get-together, you actually had to have some kind of official permission to do that. And there were a few organizations that allowed people to create these computer clubs. And these clubs were where like most of this activity happened. Also at homes, but a lot of it was in the computer clubs. And those organizations were mainly paramilitary or youth organizations. And their mission was basically to kind of train young people to be able to work with computers for the betterment of the national economy and, you know, for the bright futures of socialism and so on. But in fact, most of these clubs were, you know, very kind of open-minded spaces where there was very little kind of political oversight. And this infrastructure was incredibly important. It gave people space to gather because these organizations provided these spaces. And it's offered people also the opportunity to publish. They could publish these newsletters where this information was circulating. they could not be sold publicly. Like, you couldn't buy them at a, like, a newsstand, but they were only distributed to the members. And it was one of the few ways in which you could actually kind of publish without going through like the censorship authorities. If it was just for the club, you actually didn't have to do that.
The gaming then became part of this rich zine scene in Czechoslovakia that you've been, as a whole collaborative, you wrote a book about Czech zines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were other kinds of communities that, you know, did similar things, partook in similar activities. Like, the science fiction community was very strong, and they were really interesting and very cool looking science fiction zines with amazing illustrations. There was also like a network of sort of people who were interested in rock music, but that was much more sort of censored, and that was much more intensely scrutinized by the authorities, because they thought that rock music is subversive, but they didn't really think that computer games can be subversive. So there was a lot of interesting parallels between the hobby computing and gamer communities and, for instance, science fiction communities, or even communities like kind of car tuning or kind of automobile kind of fan communities, or aviation fan communities and so on, because they had to kind of employ similar strategies or similar tactics, actually, to kind of be able to gather, to be able to work. They kind of had to in some way infiltrate this infrastructure of these paramilitary organizations or youth organizations.
So tell us about the games themselves. How are you getting access to software during that period?
Yeah. It was most of the software that was circulating in the country was Western software, and especially British, because the most popular computer in the country was the Sinclair ZX Spectrum produced in the UK. And the way it got into the country is... it was not easy. I think the historical evidence points to the fact that it didn't really travel directly from the UK to Czechoslovakia, but usually like through other countries. So, for instance, a game was produced in the UK, and then somebody would bring it to Poland, which was relatively a little bit more liberal country at that time than Czechoslovakia. It, for instance, it kind of allowed limited free enterprise, so that could be like small companies doing things. And in Poland, there was a cracker that would crack or remove the copy protection mechanism that was implanted in the game by the British developers. And then the game could be kind of freely copied from tape to tape, and then through there it would get to Czechoslovakia. Another route was through Yugoslavia and Hungary, which were also slightly more liberal. Yugoslavia was quite liberal, but Hungary was a bit more liberal than Czechoslovakia. So these were some of the routes that the kind of software kind of took to come to the country. And then people would just trade software. They would bring it to the clubs and they would make copies for their friends, or they would sort of exchange software with each other. There was really no concept of copyright. Like, people didn't really think about copying software as something that would be unethical or illegal. There was this belief then that when it's in the club setting, we can all kind of share, you know, this software, this information that we got. And also, you know, the companies that made these games were like very distant. It was really difficult for people to imagine, to even like conceive of something like a game industry. They knew that somebody was producing these games in the UK or, you know, in the United States or Japan, but like how it works economically and, you know, just the structure of the industry, it was just impossible to imagine.
So Americans growing up with games during that period would have faced a certain amount of maternal and educator scrutiny, right? Saying that video games were bad for you, for violence and so forth. Mm-hmm. So what were the concerns of mothers and fathers and teachers in Czechoslovakia during that period?
Yeah, I think there was actually a lot of support for computing. So I said that the government didn't really think of getting computers to individuals, but they did support getting computers into schools. And there were some sort of kind of nationwide kind of educational programs dedicated to educating, you know, young programmers especially. So there was this kind of widespread belief that computing is the future, which is sort of paradoxical because at the same time, you know, computers were very scarce and they were hard to get. But sort of the educational sector was, you know, in the know, and they were sort of trying to promote computing among young people. And I think that many of the parents thought so too. They knew that computing was going to be the future, and they also knew that by investing exorbitant amounts of money into getting one from the West would actually kind of pay off for the kids, because they would get these skills that were rare and skills that would, you know, be very important in the future. So I think there was a lot of, you know, hope connected to computers, and, you know, and kids were spending, you know, hours trying to convince their parents that they, you know, need a computer to get better at math, or, you know, to, you know, get better at programming and so on. And many of them succeeded. So I think that there was actually a lot of support from teachers and parents at that point. I think that they didn't yet realize the content of many of those games. So I think it was seen in a rather positive light, I would say.
So what we described so far then is a culture which has learned to deal with the black market, mm-hmm. to smuggle things across borders, mm-hmm. to hack computers and get past copy protection, yeah. to defy censorship codes. So mm-hmm. this is a lot of work going on to support play.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, my first question is, what did play mean to the gaming culture that you're describing? Yeah. Why was play so urgent?
Yeah.
That you'd go through all of those means to stay connected to the computer game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. I think that in a way, gaming and other uses of computers at that time were not as separate as we might think of them now. So when you were getting a computer, there was this expectation that, you know, there were games and you would play games, but at the same time, also that you would create your own games and that you would try programming. The 8-bit computers that were popular at the time had sort of built-in interpreter of the programming language BASIC, and it basically when you turn it on, like, you could immediately start programming, and a lot of people did. So I think that play was, I mean, the meaning of play was, I think, much, much wider than today. It would sort of include not only playing the specific game as it was designed, but also, you know, hacking the game or making your own games, or even, you know, taking screenshots of the games and then printing them out, which was not easy at the time. And like all these different practices, you know, creating demos and learning how to program. I think that computer games were part of it, but it was a sort of like a very kind of all-encompassing kind of idea of playing with a computer rather than playing on a computer. People who only played games made by other people were kind of looked you know, down upon by other people, and it was considered more of a deviation from a norm than the norm in the 1980s, because people really kind of had this belief that they had to kind of be active and work for the community, not only just consume what they were getting from other people.
So I picture my friends at Electronic Arts and other major game companies heads spinning as you describe the kind of disregard for their intellectual property. But it wasn't actually about them, right? Yeah. In a sense, yeah. This was still a participatory culture, still one that's a creator and maker culture, mm-hmm. as much as a consumer culture.
Yeah, I think so. These young programmers or, you know, amateurs in Czechoslovakia, like, really respected the skills and the artistry that was behind Western games. They really, you know, they really adored those games. So it's not that they were disrespectful. I think what was happening is that they treated these games as like material for their own participatory activities rather than like a consumer object. So I think that the approach was a bit different. It was just like a stepping stone to like some other activities in a way.
So as you're pushing a little further beyond, let's say, the overground economy and into an underground economy around games, is there a politicization that's taking place? You're sort of crossing the government in a variety of ways as much as you're crossing these game companies. So,
yeah. One important aspect of gaming in Czechoslovakia and most of the Soviet bloc was that the authorities didn't really think of games as being political or potentially being subversive. And I think it was probably similar in the West. People didn't really kind of respect games as a medium. So they seemed to be like kind of trivial and, you know, only kind of good for kids, how to kind of learn how to, you know, do something on a computer, just like, you know, like trivial entertainment product. So I think they didn't realize that games could actually carry these sort of, you know, political meanings as well. So people, or these young programmers or amateurs, were sort of harnessing this new medium that they discovered to express, you know, their ideas. And it started with, you know, games that were just kind of satirical. So they were making fun of communist ideology, making fun of, you know, these icons of communist ideology, like, you know, Lenin, or they included these parodies of, you know, the communist slogans and so on. Over time, in the late 80s, you could see games coming out that were like very explicitly anti-regime. And they are some of the earliest examples of computer games that are kind of activist and that are, you know, explicitly kind of political.
So in some, I'm sort of interested in the ways we might situate this gaming culture on the one hand in relation to state censorship, mm-hmm. and on the other in relation to the kind of beginnings of consumer culture mm-hmm. in the Soviet bloc.
Mm-hmm. I think many people yearned for, you know, Western technology because it was rare, it was hard to get, and it sort of had this kind of coolness of a Western product. You know, it was something like, you know, wearing, you know, Levi's jeans. Like, they were hard to get, and whoever had them kind of had this kind of coolness factor. You know, like you had to kind of smuggle them, or, you know, like you had to pay a lot of money for them. And computers and computer games were a little similar, but like the added value there was that you could actually, you know, use the computer to send messages to other people to sort of express yourself. But the sort of the consumer aspect is really important. And in a way, I think the government was, you know, kind of complicit in this whole process, kind of unknowingly, because the government really tried to keep the population quiet. So they were, you know, supporting all kinds of hobby activities, and they guaranteed like a relatively kind of acceptable living standard so that people could actually spend a lot of time, you know, partaking in these hobbies. So by doing that, they kind of gave birth to this like consumer culture. People had to kind of do something with their time. So they were, you know, buying stuff, they were building stuff. They couldn't really participate politically unless they were members of the Communist Party. So they participated in these more kind of private spheres or in these smaller communities, like the, you know, hobby computing clubs, or they were building, you know, cottages like in the woods, or just whatever you could do to kind of keep yourself occupied, because you couldn't really, you know, participate in the political realm. And there was usually not much to be had, like in terms of career. So, yeah, I mean, you usually had a job, but it was not very satisfactory, because all the, you know, the hierarchy, all the positions in the kind of top of the hierarchies were reserved for Communist Party members. So you knew that, you know, like you didn't really have that far to go. So, you know, sort of venting your energy and using your energy to do something for your family or for the community was one of the few ways of kind of fulfilling your potential and your ideas.
So what happens when the Iron Curtain falls to the gaming culture of Czech, now the newly named Czech Republic?
Yeah, I mean, the very interesting point is that computer games were actually sort of documenting this whole process in a way. So there were, you know, games being made about the demonstrations that led to the demise of the communist regime. Really, you know, interesting historical documents. So even like the Velvet Revolution itself, which kind of led to the end of the communist regime, happened on November 17th, 1989. And 2 days later, there was a computer game about it, which I think is pretty spectacular. And after that came sort of a period of transition in a way. So free market was introduced into the country, and these communities started transforming into something else. Some of them continued as amateur communities. Some of them transformed into small companies. And some of them just kind of disappeared because now people had, you know, so many different opportunities. They could travel. They could you know, start their own companies in, you know, other kind of avenues of, you know, not just computing. And in the 90s, there were, I think we can see sort of the beginnings of the game industry in the Czech Republic and Slovakia. They were producing commercial games for 8-bit computers, later 16-bit computers. Some of the games that were actually made non-commercially in the 80s were now actually being sold for money, which is quite interesting because, I mean, those games were quite popular and there was there were kind of new audiences of people waiting to play them. So some people, I mean, actually made some money selling games that had been available for free before that. And then, you know, gradually, I think that the Czech and Slovak game industries were born.
And I'm assuming that there's greater access to games from elsewhere taking place at the same time, right? So
yeah,
these startups are competing with Western game companies.
Yeah, they were. But they managed to find their own niches in a way. One of the important niches were text adventures or any other games that are kind of heavily based on text and dialogue. Because at that time, you know, the Czech and Slovak population's English skills were rather limited. So, you know, games that were heavily kind of reliant on English language text were kind of next to unplayable to most people. So these small companies were making, for example, kind of text adventures in Czech or point-and-click adventure narrative games in Czech. And this remained a profitable niche until 2000s, pretty much. And people were also sort of continued creating games for platforms that were kind of obsolete in the West because, you know, economically the country was, you know, transforming and the GDP was rising, but at the same time, you know, it was still kind of lower than in the West. So people kept using 8-bit computers until the, you know, mid-90s, unlike, you know, in the West where, you know, by the end of the 80s, it was pretty much over.
So this is a fascinating story, I think, that speaks to a lot of questions, not just about games, but about culture in the Cold War era, the politics, access to technology, and so forth. Tell us, but I'm intrigued by the process of writing a history of gaming, you know, which is so dispersed and relatively underground and relatively contemporary. So where did you track down some of the information you're relying on here?
It's not easy. There are no kind of official records of this. Although the clubs were backed by these socialist organizations, there are very few records of what was actually going on that would be taken by, you know, by the authorities. So you have to kind of follow the communities by writing the history from bottom up, basically. Good entry point is our contemporary retro gaming communities, because a lot of the people who were active in the 80s are still active in those retro gaming communities, or at least some people from the retro gaming communities have contact info for these people. So that's a good place to start. And I did a lot of interviews for this book. It was over 50 interviews. People have been really forthcoming and kind of really happy that they're, you know, efforts are being kind of chronicled and you know, being made public. Yeah, but at the same time, you know, people, when you interview people, they, you know, tend to remember some things and forget other things. Some people like to remember how bad it was under communism. Other people like to remember how cool it was to be in the clubs. And it's like always very biased. So another source that proved to be very valuable are club newsletters. And I mentioned that the clubs were putting out their kind of club, you know, little club magazines. And those are sometimes available scanned online on these fan websites. Sometimes I got some from my informants, from my interviewees themselves. And this has like really kind of interesting information that was sort of contemporary to those activities. Sometimes, you know, you can get even statistics like how many members this club has and, you know, what happened and at this particular meeting of the club, or even like how many women there are in the club and things like that. Yeah, and I've been collecting these newsletters, interviews, also material artifacts, and games themselves. I think that, in a way, the process of writing was very emergent, in a way. So I didn't really go into it with like a set idea or hypothesis. I think I kind of let myself be steered by the material in some ways. And when you're doing ethnographic work or this kind of, you know, histories of small communities, I think that's a good way to go. So I was never really sure what will come out at the end. I was always, you know, getting surprised by what I found. You know, the anti-communist regime games were not something that I expected when I was coming in, and it turned out to be one of the, you know, most fascinating things. You know, the clubs, I knew at the beginning, I knew that they existed. I never kind of could, you know, really kind of appreciate their importance before I looked at those newsletters and talked to those people. So yeah, I mean, it was, I think the history itself and the book itself is also like a collaborative participatory project.
So some listeners, the idea of writing history of video games itself may seem an alien project that feels like it's so new. But now is the time to be writing it, because you have access to those connections and can do those interviews. And really, we need to be doing this in countries all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm kind of hoping that this book can inspire other people to write game histories based in, you know, other countries than the US or Japan, to kind of create a more diverse picture of the history of computer games. So far it's been very much dominated by stories of big companies like Atari or Nintendo, but, you know, there were, you know, people in basements and people in bedrooms and people in, you know, Soviet bloc computer clubs creating games that were often forgotten but are like really interesting and can tell us something about the, you know, potential of the medium as well.
I was going to say, even in the U.S., most of the histories we have are top-down, corporately driven, tied to the specific game titles, but not histories of gamers and gaming.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are historians now who are approaching sort of the U.S. gaming history from different angles. There's, for instance, Lane Nooney has been writing histories of one particular company, Sierra Online. So she's talking about a commercial company, but she's taking really interesting perspectives on it, looking at the, sort of the labor structure of the company, and maybe not just the people who made the games, but the people who were, you know, making the packaging and printing the packaging, you know, the everyday life of workers in such a company. So I think that's one of the very interesting kind of starting points, looking at game development not just as this machine that, you know, in the end kind of spits out the final product, but as a place where, you know, people gather and people talk and people work and live.
Well, thank you so much for dropping by today. Congrats on the book, and I hope people will pick it up. Again, the title is Gaming the Iron Curtain.
Thanks so much, Henry, for inviting me.
I was really sad to not be there for the Yaroslav interview, but I could enjoy it that much more not having to listen to my own voice on the tape, just to listen to the two of you go back and forth. And it was a really remarkable conversation. I, you know, of course, enjoyed both the parallels and divergences from the West, and hearing about the onset of not just computer culture, but the hobbyist culture and the work around it, which in many ways to me was resonant with the stories that I've heard here, right? And he says, well, you know, the communist government, they didn't think that computers were for people. Now, there's a famous quote from IBM on that same front, right? So it was not in some ways so different. And that you had, again, these subcultures in a constrained environment where it's only possible to meet in very specific settings that are approved. And in this case, like a computer clubhouse, remarkably, that it gives rise to a whole range of different activities. And that in the spirit of play and creation and kind of problem solving, not seeking money, not organizing for social change, not organizing for a variety of reasons, but getting together out of this shared interest in playfulness around these new devices and the things that you can make with them and the stories you can tell and the games you can create and so on, that it gave rise to a vibrant community of people who were engaged in using those practices and media for interesting purposes.
And as we think about popular culture and social change, it's hard to think of any context where more social change occurred in a shorter period of time than someplace like Czechoslovakia, right? Under moving from the Cold War to a post-socialist country, the breakup of Czechoslovakia to the Czech Republic and Slovakia, all of that disruption. And we see in Yaroslav's story the ways in which people at every step along the way negotiated politics through popular culture, right? It's both learning to transgress, learning to break the system in a variety of ways just to be able to game, and then using games as a system of representing resistance and political struggle. You know, and at the very moment of major social disruption that would lead to the collapse of communism in Czechoslovakia, 2 days later, he tells us that there's a grassroots game representing that political struggle.
That was amazing.
That turnaround is just tells you what the infrastructure was organized, the skill sets are there, what Ethan Zuckerman would talk about, latent capacity, the ability of people to translate skills from one space to another on a dime, really, because the skills have been built up. And so, yes, it makes sense that gamers, given everything he said, would be on the front lines of the political struggles that would transform that society, and then find themselves caught up in the first strand of consumerism, the rise of new forms of capitalism, would become startup companies that have to compete with the very Western game companies that gave them the raw materials to work with from the very beginning.
Yeah, I always think of the enter the bankers. You know, here's where the money came in and the disruption, and they, you know, benefited from some amount of protection for a time, it sounds like. But I wonder, you know, that transition from we're doing it because we care about it and we love it and we feel passionate or we're curious or whatever, to now we're in the world of capitalism is always a rough one. And I feel like that's the same or similar story, you know, to this kind of story that Tim Wu has told and others of the way that we see these technologies initially as technologies for empowerment and for equality and where everyone can have a voice and so on. And then as the, you know, machinations of capitalism emerge, it gets harder and harder to do that, which is, you know, troubling.
So having Yaroslav in the studio reminded me of where I had first met him, which was at MIT, which you referred to earlier in the interview. We, Philip Tan, and had helped, who was one of our graduate students, had worked to create a lab, the Singapore MIT Game Innovation Lab at MIT, with funds from the Singaporean government that wanted to get Singaporean students from all of the universities and polytechnics in Singapore out of Singapore to come to the United States to work with MIT students to develop cutting-edge games that would then go back and seed startup companies in Singapore, open up a creative industry there. So what's fascinating, given the story he's telling about the government's resistance to gaming, here the government is funding the development of games. And leading those students, we brought together game designers, not just from the United States, from all over the world. So Yaroslav was a visiting scholar there from the Czech Republic. We had other visiting scholars from Spain, from Austria, various other countries passing through. So it was kind of the United Nations at work designing games. Two interesting things come out of that. First is resistance is always there. So the Singaporeans, first arriving free from the constraints of their home culture, the first game they decide to develop is one where players are kids chewing gum in the face of Singaporean police. And popping bubble gum gives you superpowers to battle the police.
For our listeners, of course, Singapore is famous or infamous for having made gum chewing illegal.
So anything can become a sign of resistance. And this was a very political game funded by the Singaporean government in the end. And the thing we had to put on display when the government delegations came to see how their tax dollars were at work. But the other story that comes out of that is that those guys sitting around thinking about designing games start sharing what gaming is like in their own country. And Yaroslav says that's that moment that he realized there was a unique story to tell about gaming behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War, and specifically the local details of the Czech Republic. And others are going on to write other histories of games from their own national perspective. So games as an element of culture, worthy of government funding, also can be a tool that helps us to understand the politics of those particular countries.
Well, thank you, Henry.
As always, it's fun.
The name of our show is How Do You Like It So Far? And we want to know how you like it so far. Let us know. You can find back episodes, contact information, and more resources on howdoyoulikeitsofar.org. Our show is wonderfully produced by Andrea Alarcón, Renny Svernovsky, and Sophie Maggi. I'd love it. There's plenty I can tell her. You get my mother in, she'd love it.